today, secrets, lies, and that approaching cliff. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analysis. It's Working Lotus Post, covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Today, I'm joined again by Tarek Brooker. Hello, Tarek.
G'day, Martin. How are you, mate?
Yeah, pretty good. Hanging in there, you?
Pretty much the same, mate. It's all you can do in 2020.
It's the year from hell, isn't it?
Oh, something like that. You know, it just keeps getting better. You know, you just expect, you know, sort of like meteor heading for Earth or something to be the next headline in the news.
It wouldn't surprise me, you know. And did you notice that China's now talking about swine flu as another potential catastrophe? So, you know, wherever you look, there are problems.
Absolutely. It's really quite interesting. You know, finally, all these various things that you and a lot of other people have been talking about, like, are all coming to the fore all at once, along with all these other things with the virus and everything else.
Yeah, no, it is. And I'm very intrigued by the political response, right? And, you know, there's a lot of jawboning going along. There's a lot of posturing going along, but not really a lot of good policy making that I can see.
No, there isn't. And I've found that in the last few weeks, in the run-up to the Eden Monaro by-election, which is on Saturday, it's all gone very, very quiet. You know, all of these various things where they were talking about targeted stimulus and the removal of JobKeeper. You know, for example, when we last spoke, we were talking about the removal for childcare workers.
Yeah.
And now all of that's faded away, you know, with the background of this by-election until probably next week. But it's quite interesting because, you know, last week the government, well, the Daily Telegraph reported that the government said, and I quote, senior ministers confirmed with the Daily Telegraph that we would see a $75 a week increase to JobSeeker. Mm. And then a day later, the social services minister came out and said, no, that's not happening. That's not even a proposal under consideration, even though senior ministers the very day before said to the Daily Telegraph, that is our, and I quote, preferred option. So, you know, that's the sort of, you know, the crux of the title, the secrets and the lies, because, you know, there are two very different narratives going on out there.
Right. And give you another one, and that is, of course, that defense announcement, that massive spending over, you know, 10 years or whatever it is, or multiple years, except that it's actually lower than the cross-party agreed target of 2% GDP.
Scott Morrison is a master of the announcement effect. He truly is. You know, he announces, you know, bushfire relief, drought relief, all these various different policies. And then when you actually get into the nitty-gritty, it's like, oh, they haven't even given them half the money. And he gets a lot of mileage out of that. I mean, you can't help but be impressed, you know, from a political perspective. But as a member of the public and a voting citizen, you're just sort of like, can we get a little bit of substance rather than just look at this?
Remember, he's from marketing. You know, you have to go back and remember that point, right? He is from marketing. But my point is, there was almost no critical analysis in the mainstream about that at all.
There hasn't been a lot of critical analysis about a lot of things, to be completely frank.
No.
I mean, I was going through the ABS data for the household survey in terms of the JobKeeper payments. And according to their data, the percentage of the population receiving the payment is actually much, much lower than what the government claim. Yep. You know, the other day they said there was 2.9 million people on it. Then there was a media report today saying it was 3.3 million. And then there was Josh Frydenberg on the Today program last week saying it was 3.5 million. And there's all these very different figures going around. Now, I got the information from the ABS and then extrapolated that out on the working age population between 18 and 64. And I came to a number of only about 2.35 million actually covered by the JobKeeper scheme. And I know that you've seen some issues in terms of the participation too.
Yeah. Yeah, my proxy, and basically that's from my surveys up, as it were, is it isn't more than 2.5 million. So that's lower than even the revised government figures. And what's happening is that some of those businesses who thought they were going to take it, and they might have even applied to take it, didn't actually. Right? The reason is that, one, in some cases, revenue wasn't as deeply cut as they thought it was going to be. But two, all the hoops and, you know, everything else they had to jump through made it impossible to administer. So they just backed away and said, no, too hard. I'm not going to do that.
Absolutely. I mean, there are so many holes in this government's budget in terms of all these different various programs. I mean, the whole robo-debt scenario played out over $721 million. You know, that's how much has been refunded and rescinded. And, you know, that allegedly led to the deaths of up to 2,000 people. Now, how connected that is still a matter of conjecture. But it's extremely concerning that we were going through all that effort over all that time for $721 million when, if the figures that the ABS have produced are correct, the cost of that over the lifetime of the JobKeeper program is over $22 billion. And robo-debt is chump change. Literally almost every other budget item is chump change.
Yep.
And it's extremely concerning, even as well with the government-backed small business loans. You know, they allocated $40 billion for that. They've maybe done two and a half at most.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, there's going to be a huge victory lap for Josh Frydenberg after all this and go, look at how much we saved.
No, well, you're right. Almost everywhere you look, the number announced to make a splash is huge, and the reality of what actually is paid out is small. It's often paid out over multiple years and things like that, like some of the bushfire stuff. And so you're right. In a way, this is all about budget protection, isn't it?
Absolutely. I think the infrastructure announcement is another key one. You know, they're talking $70+ billion worth of infrastructure, but 97% of it was either already approved, like the Snowy Hydro scheme, which is actually going to be starting, or it's so far into the future. Like, I mean, 97% of it isn't coming until March 2022, which is conveniently just 2 months before when the next election needs to be held, which means that if they do approve it and Labor wins the election, all of a sudden, all the debt is suddenly Labor's problem.
Yeah, and I suspect there's some structuring going on. I always think that, you know, the key milestone on the PM's wall is next election, right? So therefore, I need to do this and this, and I want to make sure that house prices don't fall too far before the election. I'll kick as much of the debt as I can over past the next election to basically shape the story as best able I can. And I'll give you another interesting example. You know, Western Australia announced some stimulus land and package support as well as the federal stuff, right? And 2 months ago, there were about 220, 230 land packages sold in a typical month. Guess what it was last month?
I believe you said it was 1,600 in your interview last night with Tony McAntro.
1,600! I mean, what a huge jump, right? And purchased by people in areas where there is already massive overdevelopment happened, where there's massive amounts of, you know, property for sale and property price falls. I mean, this is another great example of the story sounds good as a press release, but look at the execution and look at the implications. It's just nuts.
Absolutely. And there's no guarantee that all of those people are going to get the grant anyway, given all the various different hoops you need to jump through. It needs to be done by this date. The house needs to be completed by this date. All these various different criteria.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I think one of the really interesting things about the entire way the Morrison government is handling this crisis is, since in the last few weeks, we haven't really seen anything about any sort of larger plan. You know, anything that's like, I mean, say in America, just today, the House approved a $1.5 trillion stimulus program, which is, you know, huge and will probably be front-loaded in all likelihood. But here in Australia, especially over the last few weeks, there's been very, very little. And considering how slow the wheels of government generally move, I think that should be of quite some concern for the Australian people. Because realistically, if they're going to come up with a better plan or some other sort of series of programs to sort of support the economy, they really do need to do that now. So really, I mean, if we get to, say, September 27th, JobKeeper ends, you know, the JobSeeker supplement ends shortly after, and what does the government do? You know, if they do panic, the scope of things that they could potentially implement is relatively limited. Now, I think that they're probably either going to extend it to some degree, or I think it's also possible that there's going to be pressure on ScoMo from the party room, and we'll see targeted stimulus at various sectors, you know, tourism, hospitality, education, etc. But by the same token, that's not going to work. And then, as we previously discussed, I think it's entirely possible then they just panic and then throw the kitchen sink at it all over again like they did back in March.
Well, there's certainly a risk of that. And, you know, it's what's interesting, you know, they actually did offer a very small piece of support for the entertainment sector, right? But that was capped, and it's a small number. Whereas, of course, the building sector support is uncapped. It's basically demand-led. That tells you something about the relative priorities, doesn't it?
Well, absolutely. I mean, we are the houses and holes economy, aren't we? You know, there really isn't anything else, and there really isn't any vision. I mean, you know, I mean, even I look at, say, Boris Johnson in the UK. You know, he's talking about, you know, transforming the UK economy, you know, funding education, rebuilding schools and vocational colleges and all those types of things. And here in Australia, it's like, well, we're going to do Work Choices 2.0. We're going to subsidise the gas industry, and we're going to try and keep the construction industry ticking over, even though the AI group PCI came out yesterday, and frankly, it looked like more abysmal data that was already coming from before the virus even began.
Yeah, well, that's the point, of course. There were a lot of cracks appearing before the virus appeared. And, you know, the real story here is that the momentum in the economy is beginning now to create problems for existing companies, large companies, with workforces that are too big for them, right? I'm looking at the consulting sector, I'm looking at the airline sector, I'm looking at other industry sectors too. So the first wave of job cuts and losses were actually in the informal sector, the part-time workers, all those things, because they could be turned off immediately, right? Whereas now what we've got is we've got structural issues in the employment sector, which suggests to me that the employment number is going to be a lot higher for a lot longer than many people think, right? And yet there is nothing that I'm seeing from a policy perspective to in any way shift the narrative to somewhere new. We spoke a few times ago about, you know, the need for real leadership and real vision and real direction. Well, we aren't getting any of that. We're getting the same old, and of course, the next thing we'll be on is let's cut the corporate tax rate just a bit more to make it, you know, a little easier for corporates. And of course, the RBA this week said, "Well, no, don't worry, you can borrow $1 trillion, no problem, providing that the growth rate is above the repayment rate. That can go on forever." So it's crazy.
Absolutely, there's just nothing. Like I was looking at the Department of Social Services data for the number of people on the JobSeeker program. I get mixed up with all these one word, two word things that they've created. And there was 1.63 million in May. And the media's been reporting recently now that it's over 1.7 million. And that's quite a big difference between what the narrative we're hearing in the media and the narrative we're hearing from the RBA and the government, which said, "Oh no, April was the worst of it. April, May, you know, April, the beginning of May was the worst of it. That was when we were in the lockdowns. That's, you know, now people are all going to be going back to work." Mm. And the data doesn't really support that. And part of the problem is, and you're seeing this around the world, is that, you know, say in the US, some of the waiters and waitresses and hospitality staff and all those sorts of people and ride operators at Disney World were all going back to work. But you're losing engineers at Boeing. Yep. You're losing, you know, high-paying jobs. And these jobs are the ones that are going to be the hardest to get back. And I really, like you say, there isn't really a plan. You know, we need something to help the economy through this, because what's happened is that we had the job losses from the lockdowns and the virus, and now we're seeing the job losses from the recession.
Yep. No, that's right. And the worrying thing about all of this is that some of those people who are now finding themselves unemployed had incomes way above what JobKeeper is offering, right? Whereas a lot of the early ones, quite a few people actually benefited from that. They actually ended up being paid more than they were previously, right? But now we've got gaping holes in a number of sectors where people's income, people in certain jobs for a long period of time, their income stopped or is about to stop. And that is why I'm very bearish with regard to mortgage stress, which I'm seeing in my data, and, you know, people's financial footprint, because it's now not necessarily just the secondary incomes that are actually at threat. These are primary incomes from mainstream employed people in senior roles, at senior levels in large organizations, who are paid a lot of money, and suddenly that's going away. So that's why the shift in the economy is very profound, and why I think this is going to be a long-term problem for us.
Absolutely. I mean, I look at some of these forecasts from the RBA talking about unemployment under their sort of better case optimistic scenario, unemployment being back at 5% by this time in 2022.
Yeah.
And it's utterly farcical.
They've been so good, haven't they, at forecasting over the last 5 years?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you just look at the wage growth forecast. They're so on point.
There is a wonderful chart, I'm sure you've seen it, that basically says, this is what they said, this is what happened. This is what they said, this is what happened. They have been consistently wrong and majorly wrong, for nearly a decade, actually.
Yeah, exactly. And I really do think that that's something that's sort of become a little bit systemic, because all of these various forecasts coming out, and I just, even the downside scenarios to me, I mean, perhaps I'm being overly bearish, but to me, the downside scenarios aren't really sort of conveying the risk going forward that this is a long and protracted thing, and that we are going to see global headwinds, you know, sort of pushing back our recovery over time. I mean, a lot of people are pointing to the mining sector at the moment, saying, well, you know, we're exporting so much more iron ore, the prices are higher. But at the end of the day, that only really benefits the budget and headline GDP in terms of here in Australia. And most of the profits flow overseas, the vast majority, in fact, of the profits flow overseas. So, I mean, I feel like we're a little bit of a one-trick pony that's had one of its legs chopped off and it's just hobbling around hoping for the best. It's
going around in a circle because it can't do anything else. And the other point, of course, there is the exchange rate's moved against us, right? So one of the reasons why the terms of trade this month were lower than last was the move in the exchange rate. So the value of coal and the volume of coal was down, and that was all to do with the exchange rate movement, which has gone 3.5% against us in a month.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's something that the RBA is going to really have to start to look at if this continues, especially if the economy continues to weaken. Because, I mean, you look at the trade data and you look at the absolute collapse in imports. And this was in an economy that was already not doing that well. We didn't really have high levels of inventory for a lot of these companies because they were waiting until the new year, until the Chinese factories started up after Chinese New Year to do all their orders. And we're still seeing imports down, I mean, at basically 2015, 2016 levels, and they've been absolutely smashed.
Yeah, no, that's right. And, you know, the expectation has to be more of the same ahead, I think, as well. And with borders closed, with no students, no tourism, those are going to be significant factors as well. And look, I want to just come back to the point you made earlier on, because you made the point that there was the COVID stuff and then we've got the recession stuff, right? Just remember that COVID is still bouncing around, right? Look at Victoria, right? We haven't solved that problem, right? I'm not even sure we're close to even understanding what we need to do to try and solve it, right? So that's still there. But the second point is the deterioration, economically speaking, was already in train before COVID hit, right? So I know COVID is being blamed as the thing that's created all the problem. No. It's amplified what was already going wrong. And the lack of strategy and direction and real enthusiasm for doing new things and taking the economy into a new, better place that we were calling out some months ago is still there. So in a way, we've just now got starting from a lower base – the same old as we had previously. And unfortunately, the cupboard's bare as far as I can see.
I completely agree. I mean, I've been sort of thinking as to how all this sort of comes together, you know, with all the various different factors. And, you know, I'm going to share a little bit of the theory and I'd like to hear your thoughts on it. And, you know, my sort of theory is that we are entering the recession really now. We had the initial shock of COVID, of the issues with the lockdowns and people losing their jobs. But now we're entering the actual recession for the first time in 30 years with more dead weight than any economy has ever had. And my theory is that we've entered this recession and now we're going to see the slow grind down. We're going to see the job losses in all these various industries over the next sort of, you know, 18 months, 2 years, maybe longer, I don't know. But it's not something that's going to immediately bounce back. We've got a new business cycle. I don't think that's the case. We're going to see this, you know, slow grind down in employment, slow grind down in growth. And then obviously you've got the issues with the cost-cutting feedback loop from businesses, which feeds into lower employment and then so on and so forth. Now, that's sort of my base case at this point, and I'm just sort of wondering how you sort of see it.
Unfortunately, I see it pretty much the same. The only issue is, or the only opportunity is, if in fact the government does continue to invest big, and maybe it swallows some of the MMT thinking that says, yeah, we can actually throw more money at this and we can actually get some growth momentum. I mean, basically, Guy Debelle in his RBA way was actually hinting at MMT as basically a component of the solution, right? Because he basically said, look, you can do this because the rate that you pay on debt is so low at the moment and you can create some growth, you know, long-term average growth, what, 2 to 3%? What if we get there? That's way higher than the interest rates that you'd pay on any debt. So therefore, you can grow your way out of this. So, you know, if that sticks and if they actually do throw large amounts of money by way of strategic investments, well, then maybe there's a way out. But what we said earlier on was there's almost no appetite for that. The center of gravity of ScoMo and his mob is to shrink, cut, you know, do the minimum, make big announcements and then actually spend very little. And that's the fundamental disconnect that I see. There is a, you know, a way that potentially things could be improved, but I don't think they're going to go there. And that means that I think you're absolutely dead right. I think your central case is pretty much my central case. And that means that this is a 3 to 5 year grey period in the Australian economy. People are going to get squashed. Many households will lose their properties on the way through. Many people will lose their jobs. And at the moment, it's hard to see how we pull ourselves out of this. And then, of course, we come to the international context, which is also quite wonky. Oh, but, of course, the solution is we'll invite many people from Hong Kong to come and live in Australia, and that will solve the problem, won't it?
Well, I was talking to Edwin about that yesterday, and he was telling me he just doesn't see it. You know, those who were going to leave have already left.
A lot of the,
there's this idea. I mean, I forget who was saying on the news earlier. They were, you know, they're like, oh, there's 7.5 million people in Hong Kong. You know, 3 million of them are going to go to Britain, and then 4.5 million could potentially end up in Australia and elsewhere. And I just felt like saying, not all of them, A, have the money to leave, or B, want to leave.
Yep.
You know, some of them are from mainland China, and they're quite happy to be reintegrated back into the greater whole. Others are already looked at the situation and left, even more left back when it was handed over to Beijing. Mm. And, you know, I mean, Edwin's view was that they're absolutely dreaming that it's going to really make a substantial impact.
No, well, I agree, and you know, I was being tongue in cheek. I don't see it's going to, you know, solve anything much in particular. And you know, the repeated cries for China's buying our stuff again. You know, they're buying our property. No. There's very little evidence of that. And in fact, it's getting harder and harder for you know, people from there to buy property here. So I don't think we can look to that particular solution for a way out of our issue. We have to be able to create a vision. We have to create a new way of thinking about the economic future of Australia. And we have to commit to it quite quickly. Otherwise, we're in for a very long, low grind.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the part of the problem is that, you know, the rhetoric in Australia about balanced budgets, about superior economic management, while that obviously dominates the coalition's thinking, it's still a key and central point to the way that the Australian public view a government's economic management skills. And if, for example, ScoMo does pull the trigger on MMT, if he blows up the deficit, blows up the debt, there's nothing to stop Labor from using the same tactics that Tony Abbott used against them for their much, much, much smaller stimulus in relative terms, to then just hammer the crap out of them and drive them out of office. And ScoMo knows that. I mean, he is a smart guy in that particular way. And I have a hard time seeing them changing this, you know, Howard and Costello approach to budgets, to the deficit, to debt in general, in a fast enough timeline to be able to make the decisions when they need to be made.
Mm.
You know, I think that it's entirely possible they'll kick the can down the road because they have to. But I don't think that the Liberal Party is going to do that happily. And there's going to be increasingly people going, we need to end this. There's too much debt. And because there's quite a few disciples of that particular viewpoint in the Liberal Party. And I would say, to be completely honest, they're probably in the majority.
I think they probably are. And by the way, there'll be some on the other side of the house who'd actually share those views too, because in a way, both sides of politics have tended to sort of go down the same route. You know, there's a little bit of change of emphasis in terms of the investment, but neither wants to run a deficit, neither wants to, see the budget blow out particularly. So there is a fundamental philosophical roadblock here insofar that politics probably is disconnected from reality. Politics is disconnected from what needs to be done to be able to move this economy forward. And I'm not sure that we're going to break out of that. So, you know, goes back to what I say, what you're saying, it's going to be a long, slow grind.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that in a lot of ways, last year's election has really complicated things because, you know, if ScoMo does arrive with this big, broad vision of different things, that's a big departure from the way we've done things in the recent past, he faces the same uphill battle that Bill Shorten faced last year when he wanted to reform negative gearing and capital gains tax and franking credits, because it's a massive change from the way things are currently done.
Mm.
And, you know, unless he could somehow find bipartisan support on that, you know, something that could really sort of insulate him from the threat of, you know, the issues within the party room, it's hard to see him changing that. I mean, I know that's what, you know, Philip Lowe and economists and all these other people are screaming for. But as you say, in terms of political reality, it's not going to happen on the scale that they want. And I think that's going to be one of the key central themes going forward, because while we can, I mean, I think we both agree that there's definitely the possibility that they could continue the current stimulus measures, I don't think there's going to be much more on top of that, because frankly, the current stimulus measures already cost an unholy amount of money. You know, I mean, about every three weeks, we're spending a Kevin Rudd $950 cash handout. And that's just not going to fly with the Liberal Party group.
Mm. No, I think that's right. And I don't think that there's much chance of getting a consensus across the aisle. I mean, that's probably what we really need. What we really need is a national approach to this 1-in-100-year emergency that we've got, right? And basically get everybody aligned and, you know, heading off in the same direction. But that, of course, would take a completely different sort of leadership, a Churchillian sort of leadership, which we don't have.
No, he's not gonna reach across the aisle to the likes of someone like, you know, I mean, an Albo is not exactly Clement Attlee, is he?
What a thought. Tarek, you've made me feel very gloomy because I've been harboring these doubts and concerns for the last couple of months as I've been watching this play out. And, you know, you're playing the back to me, I think, has reconfirmed my initial hypothesis, is that this is not going to end well. Oh, well, we'll just keep calling it out as best we can, I suppose.
That's all we can do, mate. You know, we just hope that there are people out there who listen. And, you know, to be completely honest, looking at the May retail sales data, it's not looking too good.
Oh, it was up. Well, yeah, but it was very much down previously, so it doesn't really tell you anything. And it was as signalled. And of course, if my hypothesis on the fact that more people are going to be unemployed rather than less, then retail spending is going to continue to deteriorate. So no, I don't think that's a get out of jail card either.
No. My concern with the retail sales data isn't so much that it was good. I mean, it was record breaking, but it's more just the fact that you know, I talk to people who are on JobKeeper, JobSeeker, and, you know, there's this idea that everything's going to snap back to normal and it's absolutely fine to go out and buy a new car or use their money from their super to you know, gamble on the ASX and, go buy a new guitar or whatever it is. And, you know, there's sort of no real thought that, oh, hey, maybe I should put that $550 away because it might not always, that might not always be there.
Well, that's, of course, the issue. And, you know, if they do turn things off, people suddenly find that that money that they wanted and was actually made available to help them through, not be frittered away on frivolous things, could actually be a big issue for them.
You know, I must admit, things are deteriorating in the property market quicker than I thought they would.
Yeah. Well, it goes back to what I said. It's who's now unemployed. Mm. That's the thing that's changing, right? 6,000 from Qantas, several thousand from the big consulting firms. Some of the banks are laying people off. These are, you know, big corporate jobs with big salaries.
Yeah, a mate of mine's a financial advisor. He was telling me yesterday he had a meeting with an aircraft engineer from Qantas. Guy was on $170,000 a year. You know, he's now on JobKeeper.
Yep.
He's an older fella, so he's probably not going to get his job back, he reckons.
And that's the point. So early on, a lot of people got actually a pay rise because of JobKeeper, because they were earning less, right? But now it's the other way around. So JobKeeper is not sufficient to keep those people with large mortgages and school fees and everything else running.
I think that's really key, though, isn't it? I mean, yeah. You know, like you think about some of these private school fees, you know, $15,000-$20,000 a year a kid. You know, if you want to keep your kids with their friends in private school, all of a sudden that's JobKeeper gone.
Correct. And quite often it was two incomes and now they're down to one income. And if that one income is the second income and a part-time income at that, I might get JobKeeper on top. But, you know, the financial pressures that I'm seeing in my surveys, the latest data will come out on Monday, it's going through the roof. So, yeah, this is, yeah, not good.
No, I mean, it's kind of scary. Like, we talk about this scenario playing out like a normal sort of recession of the slow grind down. But then I just think, you know, if we do see a housing crash, if things all of a sudden go island on us, you know, if we see a tightening of credit or whatever the catalyst is, things could get really bad really, really quickly. And that's even, you know, I mean, that makes our base case look like Sesame Street.
Yeah, you're right there. Tarek, I appreciate your time today. Very interesting as always. And, you know, I always love comparing your thoughts and my thoughts because we sort of travel in slightly parallel universes. When we cross, we just need to hit the same point, which is, I'm not sure who should be more concerned, actually.
Yeah, it's a pretty concerning thing going forward, mate. It certainly is.
Well, we'll pick up the conversation again down the track and see how right or wrong we are. Maybe there will be a rabbit pulled out of a hat somewhere and suddenly, magically, it'll all click back and the sun will come out, the birds will sing, the choir will be, you know, there in the background and suddenly we'll be in Nirvana or not.
Well, maybe ScoMo will get possessed by Churchill and Albo will get possessed by Attlee and we'll find a way out of this.
Well, fingers crossed. Thanks, Tarek. See you soon.
Later, mate.
Bye.